What's up, guys? Kevin Estella here with Fieldcraft Survival. I want to recognize some of our sponsors that make this podcast you're about to hear possible. First one is Sig Sauer. Sig Sauer is the leading name in the United States when it comes to firearms and training. Solid folks at the Sig Sauer Academy. I don't think they get enough credit. These dudes are awesome. These gals are awesome because let's not forget Hannah Billadoo, who's a total badass chica. She's over there along with all my good buddies from the Sig Sauer Academy. Guys, Sig makes some fantastic pistols. I've been playing around lately with the Sig M400 Tread, and that AR-15 platform, I mean, it's got great fit and finish, super accurate. I've let a bunch of students try it in courses. Very, very pleased with it, and I've never had an issue, knock on wood. The other gun that is one of my favorites that I travel with a lot is the Sig 365. The Sig 365 is a fantastic firearm in that it's a striker-fired pistol. That pistol is one that you can change into the small configuration or the large configuration, so the standard or the XL. You can go from a 10-round mag to a 15-round mag. You can do a lot with the 365 XL. And you can also put a weapon light on it, like the TLR 7 Sub, making it a great backwoods gun. So check that one out if you get a chance. And like I said, check out the Sig Sauer Academy. It's up in Epping, New Hampshire. If you go up there, stay at the Exeter Inn, eat at Goody Cole's, swing over to Kittery, go shopping over there. You can make a whole vacation out of going to the Sig Academy. And I'm excited to be up there this September. I'll be teaching Modern Survival Skills September 9th, which that class, as of this recording, is over halfway filled. And it will be a great time being up there for the first time as an instructor at the school where I train 20-something times. So really excited to be back up there. The other podcast sponsor I want to recognize is Vertex. Vertex has been in the game for a long time. I mean, I remember wearing Vertex pants at the Wilderness Learning Center in the early 2010s. And, you know, I still have Vertex pistol magazine pouches that I use when I go to the range just to keep all my stuff organized. And a bunch of the folks here carry various firearms in Vertex bags, which are designed to, you know, carry short-barreled rifles or pistol caliber carbines or pistols with suppressors on them. So guys, please check out vertex.com. They've got a whole line of clothing that, like I said, I've worn for many years. It's tough as nails. I still have a pair of Vertex pants that I wore on a pilot TV show that I was on back in like 2016, which, you know, required me to hike through the desert like 28 miles over 3 days. And I mean, I was dragging those pants over rocks and through briars and all sorts of crap. I still have pine sap in those pants from that trip. And yeah, they're lasting. So guys, check out Vertex when you get a chance. That's V-E-R-T-X. And see all the stuff that they have to offer. The last thing I'm going to say is please check out the classes that we have coming up. We are training all across the country. I will be in New Hampshire. I'm going to be in Connecticut. I'm going to be back in Utah. I'll be all over. So if you're looking for survival training, check it out. You can see where I'm going to be. And of course, I'm based here in North Carolina at our fire base out here. So please check us out in Aberdeen. If you know anyone in the Fayetteville area, Charlotte, we're less than 2 hours away. So come and check us out. All right, guys, it is time to get to this podcast. So here we go. Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm going to be your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm the director of survival training, and I'm joined by a gentleman who was a prisoner of war for 100 days in Vietnam after his B-52 was shot down. Bob Certain is joining us today, and he is going to answer your questions. So we'll get to know a little bit about Bob, his experience, but then he's going to jump right to the questions that you provided to me that I in turn provided to him. And this is driven by you. So, he had a couple laughs at some of the questions, and I think he's going to, give you guys some insight, that you haven't heard before. So Bob, thank you so much for joining us, and, let's get this show on the road.
All right then.
All right. So can you kind of give us a quick, you know, summation of your time leading up to the time that you got shot down, like your background?
Okay. I was a young captain in the Air Force at the time, a navigator on a B-52G model. I had flown 50 missions in D models out of Thailand in 1971. And then in middle of 72, we were sent with our G models to Anderson Air Force Base on Guam. And that I was scheduled to rotate back to the United States on the 18th of December, 1972. But linebacker two intervened. Rotations were canceled on the Friday, and we were scheduled in to fly the first night of linebacker two, taking off mid-morning, about 60 or 70 B-52s off the island of Guam. We were the 19th in the row, and out of 27 going against a rail yard in the northeast corner of Hanoi. So we flew across the Pacific, across South Vietnam, up through Laos, in the western North Vietnam, up towards the China border, then looped around so that we were coming in from the northwest. And everything was perfect on the airplane. It was working well. The bombing system was perfect. At 10 seconds to go on the bomb run, we got hit by the first of two surface-air missiles. And missiles don't actually hit airplanes. They blow up near them. And then the shrapnel punches through the skin, gets ingested by engines, destroys the engines. So we lost some engines, maybe as many as four of the eight. Two crew members were mortally wounded, the pilot and the gunner. We had fire in the forward wheel well. We jettisoned the bombs at the bomb release point and then ejected.
How high up were you?
We were about 35,000 feet.
You ejected at 35,000?
Yeah, it seemed like the thing to do at the time. The airplane was about to blow up.
Oh my gosh.
Unbeknownst to me, it was hit by a second SAM about the time I ejected. And so it was a big fireball because we had over 100,000 pounds of jet fuel on board. My brother, who was flying a KC-135 refueler out over the Gulf of Tonkin, saw it go up, that is, blow up, and didn't know I was in it because he thought I was going home. So I ejected at bomb release point, and we say it's generally that's a bad idea to eject over the target you just bombed. And I thought, well, especially when you're number 19 and there are eight more behind you going to drop bombs on that same target, and those bombs will be falling around you as you free fall. So you free fall from ejection altitude to 15,000 feet. Parachute opens automatically starting at 15,000 feet. And when it was fully deployed, I looked down between my boots and saw the conflagration on the ground and watched bombs blowing up straight through that rail yard. And I thought, you could get killed doing stuff like this. So the wind shifted. I was able to steer the chute a little bit by pulling on the risers and drifted off to the west. The airplane hit the ground. I drifted over that, touchdown. And one of the questions that was asked was, how did you get captured? Well, it was a full moon. And I had a white helmet, and there were white panels in the parachute. And when I touched down, I was rolled into a ditch along a railroad track, and there were villages all around. And so they could see me coming. And about 3 to 5 minutes later, they saw me and invited me to come up out of the ditch, and I was captured.
One of the questions that hasn't come up yet in any of the interviews that I've done here for this weekend at Randolph Air Force Base is the equipment question. You know, I know many prisoners of war say that prior to getting captured, they were ditching their equipment. They didn't want their equipment being captured as well. Did you do that? Or?
Well, I was getting away from it as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. The seat kit in a B-52 ejection seat is filled with a raft and a rifle and various and sundry other survival items. And I just wanted to get away from where I touched down because I figured if they were going to shoot, they were going to shoot that spot. And sure enough, they did. I was probably 50 yards down the ditch when I looked back and saw the firing going on down there. When they spotted me, I remembered I had a 38 Smith & Wesson Combat Masterpiece fully loaded with six bullets in my survival vest. So I pulled it out, opened the cylinder, ejected the bullets, threw them as far as I could, jammed the barrel into the dirt, because I figured if they're going to shoot me, they can use their own weapon. And I forgot I had a switchblade knife in my leg sleeve. So And they, you know, they spotted me and so captured me. And then they searched me basically by taking my clothes. Wow. It was very effective. They left my skivvies on. I was T-shirt and shorts was all. But they took my flight suit, my survival vest, my boots, socks. And there I was in the middle of December. It was freezing cold. And walking on a railroad track with bare feet. So that was, I didn't have any survival equipment left at that point.
Mm-hmm. Did you suffer any injuries from the free fall and from landing?
My ego strength was devastated. I didn't have physical injuries until some woman came up behind me with a rock in her hand, hit me in the head, and drew a little blood on the back of my head. But the militia that were involved in this group, mostly civilians, but there were four militia with automatic weapons, and they protected me from the civilians. There was a price on my head, of course, and they wanted to get me into Hanoi. So, and then in the transport phase, I was in a Jeep-like vehicle, and a couple of times when we were walking, I was walking, they're taking me to the road where I'd be picked up, and I thought they were going to kill me because we can't. I was blindfolded, but I could see below it. And with a full moon, I could see sort of a black and white grayscale surroundings. And so we turned a corner, a curve in this path, and there was a mound of dirt off to the right. And the guard behind me fixed the bayonet on his rifle. And I thought, well, this is where it ends. But we kept going. And then when we got to the Red River to cross into Hanoi, there was a ferry there, ferry crossing, and the guys turned around and started beating on me with their fists while I was in the back of their Jeep. And that was about it. After we got into Hanoi and I was in the prison itself, I felt some relief that I was going to be okay. I was threatened a lot. You tell us what we want to know, we'll take you where the B-52s are bombing. Well, I didn't think they were going to do that because I figured they didn't want to leave the building any more than I did. Mm-hmm. And so the survival school training about the POW training that we had had, it was almost like deja vu all over again.
So the unique perspective that you have is that you came in later in the war.
Correct.
And you spent 100 days. So when you got there, there were already American POWs that could share their experiences and tell you, like, what was that like when you got there and you knew, oh my gosh, there's other Americans here?
Well, the Hanoi Hilton was basically chock full. And I was kept in an interrogation room for most of the time that I was in the Hilton, but we were not allowed to meet, visit with, and they were in the back of the other sections, and there were big walls between us. So I never got to talk to any of them. So we didn't know. We had not been briefed that the torture had ended when Ho Chi Minh died back in 69. We didn't know what kind of treatment to expect, and being the first B-52 crew members to be captured, I had no idea what to expect in so far as treatment or if I'd be sent to the Soviet Union or whatever. So I was standing there trying to evade questions as best I could by telling him I'm just a celestial navigator. All I do in that airplane is navigate over water and using the sun or the stars. And I don't know anything about bombs, missiles, radar sets, or anything else. Of course, I knew it all, but I wasn't telling them that.
Right. Wow. So now you settle into prison life. And what was the greatest shock to you, like shock to the system? Because, you know, you think about it like the average person, you wake up, the average person listening wakes up, goes to the bathroom, brushes their teeth, makes breakfast, goes to work. Like, what was the greatest shock to your system in terms of a new routine, something that became the new normal?
Well, our new normal was very different from that. Mm-hmm. First of all, we didn't have a bathroom. Mm-hmm. We had basically a 5-gallon paint can. The meals were brought to us, you know, room service. We had breakfast was a half a loaf of French bread and some reconstituted powdered milk, very sweet powdered milk. And then lunch was cabbage soup sometimes with a little fat back in it, another half a loaf of French bread, and some weak tea, and dinner was the same as lunch. And then the day after I was captured, they threw another prisoner in that was off the second B-52 to get shot down. And then the next day, there was a U.S. fighter flying over the city that got fired on by AAA anti-aircraft artillery that was near the Hilton, which irritated him, so he dropped a 500-pound bomb on it. And the overpressure of that explosion pushed, we had wooden French doors on this room we were in, this interrogation room. They were hinged to open to the outside. Instead, they opened to the inside from the overpressure, and then the underpressure slammed them shut, and one of them fell off. That was a kind of a shock. And the guard came in with his AK-47 yelling at us, and we were laying on our pallets. And we didn't do that. We were not going to escape in the downtown Hanoi. So at that point, that room was rendered uninhabitable. And they moved us to a section we call the Heartbreak Hotel, which were 6 by 6 foot cells with 2 foot wide concrete bunks built into them. So it had a 2 foot wide aisle in the middle, 6 feet long. And we were kept back there for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks until the bombing ended. But the same kind of routine. We didn't have toothbrushes and toothpaste, so we never brushed our teeth for probably 2 or 3 weeks before they gave us that stuff. But we could talk freely to each other. We could even raise our voices and try to talk to the guys in the cell next to us. They'd yell at us, but they didn't punish us for doing it. The tap code was no longer necessary because after the Santé raid and the North Vietnamese closed a lot of the outlying prison camps and moved everybody in the Hilton. So there were big cells with lots of guys in them, and they could talk across the way. And so we could talk to each other. There was a cell that had, where it's a sort of a water faucet where we could bathe, and the older prisoners, as they walked by, would try to communicate with us, but they'd get yelled at and shoot away. After the bombing stopped in about mid-January, we moved to a different prison, and had daily times outside the cells in a courtyard with about probably 20 guys in that cell block.
Wow. So, I've spoken to a few gentlemen here so far. Everyone's got a very different experience. This one sounds like you're shedding more light on the experience later in the stay at the Hilton. I'm curious your responses to those questions. There are so many there that touch upon so many different topics throughout that stay. And you said prior to this podcast, you said some of them aren't relevant, but then there were some that kind of struck a chord with you. So would you mind responding to some of those questions?
The very first one that I look at is, did you have conversations with God? Well, yeah, I became a chaplain after I left prison. The Air Force sent me to seminary, and I became an Episcopal priest. But on the way down in the parachute, I was before the parachute opened, one of my little arrow prayers to God was, if I'm going to die tonight, let the parachute stay in the pack, and I'll just hit the ground and die. And when it opened, and it was a good parachute, and I thought, okay, God, I'm going to be a prisoner of war, and so I need you with me. My faith was never challenged, really. It was more bolstered. And then as I talked to the other prisoners about what we're going to do when we get home, and I said, well, I'm going to leave and go to seminary, then they all said, well, that's good. They thought that was a good thing. And so that was one of the things that really kind of resonated, obviously, with what happened with me for the rest of my life. I wound up serving in the Air Force for 30 years, and 27 of them was a chaplain all after I came home. There were three of us that did that, all Air Force, that went to seminary and became Air Force chaplains. And I was never really afraid after the first night that I would die. That was another one of the questions. And the second day, the day after I was captured, they had six of us, two from my crew and four from this next crew that went down, and they took us over to a prison we call the Plantation, where it was a kind of an auditorium where they did news conferences, and took us in one at a time. And when I walked in and saw all these Europeans with cameras, I thought, I'm going home.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say anything. I just looked at all those cameras, made sure that everybody had a chance to get a good photograph, because I knew that once it hit the wire services, that there would be some splaining to do if I didn't show up at home again. So I was rejoicing that, okay, the worst is over. The worst thing they can do to me now is maybe beat me a little bit and threaten me with death and destruction. But I knew that at that point, there would be a trip home before too much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they moved us from the Hilton over to the zoo, the Kulak prison, we discovered as people got populated over there that we had all been down less than 18 months. And so we knew that they were reorganizing the prisoners in order of shoot down date and to facilitate the peace treaty and the returns. And then the first day, so when the treaty was signed at the end of January, they called us into an assembly room a couple of days later and told us that the Paris Peace Accords had been signed and we'd be returning stateside on an every other week basis. And we knew that since we were the last captured, we'd be the last to go home.
That decision to release by shoot down date, now that wasn't decided upon by the POWs. That was by the accord, right?
It was by the accord, but it was also part of the code of conduct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's first in, first out. So the first release were the wounded from December.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some of those. And then the longest held. And then, so we were going to be the last day. We knew that March 29th would be the final day and we'd be leaving on that date.
A question that I haven't asked anyone yet is, how were you getting this information and how did you know that it was credible?
Well, we knew that the North Vietnamese called us into an assembly to announce the treaty. But other information came to us from General Flynn, who was held over in the zoo, in the Hilton. And every morning we'd get a news flash from him and obviously somebody had to be carrying it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guards or a trustee of the North Vietnamese or somebody would have to get it to us over in the other prison. I didn't know how they did that. I still don't know how they did that, but I was grateful to get it. And everything was falling into place. And then right after before the first releases, there were C-130s. We could see the traffic pattern at GLM Airport. And there were C-130s, hours, coming in and out for some reason. And then the day of the first release in mid-February, we were in our afternoon lockdown period for our afternoon naps, and we heard the whine of C-141 and jumped up to the window and saw this 141 coming in on final approach with a big red cross on his tail, and we knew the first guys are going out, and the guy made a missed approach.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, oh, crap, something went wrong. But he turned and flew directly towards our prison, waved his wings, and went back around and landed. And, of course, we were all cheering and shouting and rejoicing, and the guards were saying, you must be quiet, you must be quiet. We're not being quiet anymore. So we figured out everything is working according to Hoyle and that we're proceeding in a credible fashion towards our release.
Wow. What else stands out there on that sheet?
Well, some of this was like, please tell your story. Well, I just did portion of that. The communication deal was by voice. towards the end. You know, one of the things, it was one of the questions, what would you do if you, one of your captors on a dark road, what would you do? Well, I would probably introduce myself and shake his hand. I just came back from Hanoi 2 weeks ago. I went over there for our 50th freedom trip. Mm-hmm. And there was a North Vietnamese general, or Vietnamese general, retired, who met with us. And he said, you know, when during the war, we were doing the bidding of our nation to for our country's purposes. But after the war, we don't need to be enemies. And he told the story of shooting down an American aviator near the border with Laos, who was then rescued. But then he was later shot down by an American aviator himself. And so he's been to the United States, I think he said 11 times. He's met with both of those men and has become friends with them. One of the guys that went with us on this trip, there were eight of us, had gone to Hanoi first. We went at the end of our trip, but he went he went there first and met with the pilot who shot him down. So this is 50 years ago,
right?
And so there's no hostility left, my opinion was that we probably should have established political relationships with Vietnam a lot sooner than we did. It was during the Clinton administration when we finally did establish relationships, and our first ambassador was a long-term POW.
Now, that understanding of, I think I would shake hands with him. Is that the soldier, or I should say the airman in you responding, or the chaplain, or do you think it's a combination of?
I think it's mostly the warrior.
Okay.
You know, we don't take war personally when we're fighting it. It's dangerous to take it personally because then you get out of whack like My Lai, mm-hmm. some bad stuff. I was thinking that when I was first captured, the civilians wanted to kill me, and the militia is what protected me from the civilians. So the warrior doesn't, sees the political decisions to go to war as a decision that we're executing, but because of political reasons, not because we hate people.
Yeah, I think, like, you can see examples of that throughout history where, you have the non-professional combatant, right? And they don't follow the rules, where the warrior has that strict code of conduct that they
Correct.
Have to live by. And I think that is something that when we look at Vietnam, or you look at Afghanistan, or you look at any of the conflicts throughout history where you have that blend of like a formal military, but then you have the enemy being comprised of a formal military and then, the Viet Cong, the farmer during the daytime, the fighter at night.
You know,
I think that's where things really get muddy. And the sad part for me, like when I think about this and I think about my friends, my late mentor who was over there, he said Vietnam was one of the most beautiful countries he's ever visited. He's like, there are stunning beaches and the landscape is gorgeous. And, he's like, if it wasn't a war-torn country, it would be a great place to live,
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel about the landscape and the people over there and what it was and the effects of communism on that?
Well, the effects of communism is strange over there.
Yeah.
First of all, it's beautiful. We just did a river cruise up the Mekong into Cambodia. The economy of Vietnam today is one of the fastest growing free economies in the world. They're even building electric vehicles in California now to compete with the Tesla. And so when they first reunited in 75, they instituted a Soviet-style dictated mm-hmm. economy, which was a disaster because they took the land away from the farmers, put farmers where they want them, and told them, people in the Mekong Delta, to grow potatoes. Well, you can't grow potatoes in flooded fields. You can grow rice and you can grow lots of it. And so in those years, there was they started to have a famine because they couldn't produce enough food under the dictates of the Politburo. So then they adopted the Chinese format, which is to have a market economy, but keeping the communist government. So, you know, I'm not sure that people over there really are crazy about their government. But if you're not a member of the Communist Party, you don't find a really good job. So the economy was booming. The river traffic was a lot of markets, stuff going to market. A lot of businesses flourishing over mm-hmm. there, a lot of investment from everybody from China to Japan to Korea, South Korea to the United States and other countries. So it's a very, very lively place in spite of the communist government. The new guy that's just been elected as the leader of the government is a pretty hardcore communist. So I don't know how that's going to work out, but the economy is flourishing, and I think they would be hard pressed to try to dictate that economy at this point.
Yeah, that's a great perspective on it. You know, one of the things that I always ask my guests, you know, usually before the podcast is, I say, like, look, we're creating an oral history, you know, and history is really important. We're doomed to repeat it if we forget it. What do you feel is the important message you want to leave the listener with about Vietnam?
Vietnam, like any war, is the last resort of politics. You know, if diplomacy fails, then we have wars. And so it's always the best thing to have strength so that people don't follow, so the aggressors don't decide they can do a quick war against you. You mm-hmm. need to give them room for thought and pause, and then try to find a middle way. You know, Vietnam was one of those strange places that the U.S. made some big mistakes after World War II and supporting the French to return to Indochina. Ho Chi Minh had tried to set up relationships with the United States and get guarantees that they would have an independent country. Mm-hmm. And when we didn't do that and sent the French back, then he became pretty hardcore in his attitude towards the United States and France both. And of course, the French had some significant mistakes that they did. And then we got into it as advisors to start with after the French left and the country was divided, and the reasons for it, you know, the domino theory, which hasn't really played out over there, and was a big concern for the United States and for the NATO allies. And then, you know, the other big problem that I see that we did was the politicians, the civilians at the Department of Defense, Robert McNamara and the president, chose targets. Mm-hmm. And put in rules of engagement that were very difficult to follow and frequently didn't make sense. And then did this sort of graduated warfare design, which is a crazy way of doing war. Schwarzkopf in Iraq had the bright idea, is shock and awe. You know, if you're going to go to war, you need to do it with as much brutality as necessary to get it over with as soon as possible. And when you do that, you kill fewer people, you destroy less property, and you're able to repair the damages faster. When you make it last 10 or 12 years, like we did in Vietnam, and graduated, then the hostilities last for a long time.
You know, that's a universal concept, I think. I know with friends who, you know, served, they said, you know, if you're going to engage someone in any type of fight, you use your most effective tool first, right? Like if you let's break it down to like an individual combatant, right? You have a pistol, you have a rifle, maybe you have a knife on you. You don't use the knife first, you use the rifle first, right? And you use the most effective means. So this graduated idea, it's like, well, it runs counter to that on the large scale where it's ramping up the intensity as opposed to hit them hard first and, right. and be done, you know?
And so we fought that war backwards. And the most effective weapon we had was the B-52. And if we'd sent the B-52s against Hanoi 10 years earlier, they didn't have all those surface-to-air missiles. By the time we went, it was the second most heavily SAM-defended city in the world next to Moscow. And so there were a lot of SAMs being thrown up at us. There are over 1,200, I think, were fired, but they only knocked down 10 airplanes. Damaged a lot more, but they didn't kill very many of us. 700 and some odd B-52 strikes in 11 nights. And 10 airplanes went down over the city. 5 more were damaged to the point they had to leave the airplane over, eject over Thailand or South Vietnam or the ocean. And those crews were all rescued. Had we gone even 5 years earlier or 10 years earlier, for sure, we could have done it and gotten it done with in a hurry.
Right tool, wrong timing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much we could talk about. There are so many stories that we could share. What do you want people to do? Where would you want them to, like, if you said, hey, if you want to learn more, go here. What do you think is like the definitive source for more information about POWs right now?
I'm not sure there is a definitive source. A lot of us have written books mm-hmm. over the years, some of which are still in print. Lee Ellis has gone about trying to teach lessons of leadership that he learned in the prison camps, many of us have done the Library of Congress Oral History Project, and mm-hmm. you get our names. You can Google our names. You can find all kinds of things about what our experience was and how we say it. But you'll also find some common themes, I think, in there, and that is, fear is part of our life, and courage is acting in spite of the fear, and then when everything is taken away, like it was for us as prisoners, they still can't take away your mind very easily, and as long as you can communicate with other prisoners, you can survive it. And so community is a big deal, mm-hmm. and maintaining community and finding a way that everybody can benefit. And that's one of the things that concerns me about our political situation in the country today, mm-hmm. is that we seem to have gone to two extremes and nothing in the middle. And compromise, which used to be a value when I was a boy, has become an anathema in the modern political stage. And that's the pendulum has to swing back towards the middle, I hope. Pretty soon.
Yeah, you hear people say all we have in this country now is just a whole bunch of argument, when debate is healthy, discussion is healthy. Argument seems like people have lost the art of argument, and it's just, let's be the loudest person, let's yell a whole bunch of nonsense, and that means winning an argument. And that's not moving us forward.
No, it doesn't.
Exactly. So... Well, I don't want to keep you from the festivities this weekend. What do you think the highlight is going to be for you this weekend? Because you have a number of folks who are going to take their champagne flight, right? I think that, is that taking place today or tomorrow?
It's supposed to take place today. It depends on the weather.
Right, right.
And I was looking at the weather earlier. I thought, it's pretty low cloud cover. I'm not sure they're going to do it because it's all visual flying, and I'm not sure what they're going to do, but we'll see.
So what do you think the highlight's going to be for you?
Well, that's always a highlight, is to see guys do their champagne flight and to visit with people that we've shared a lot of experience with over the years, both in prison and beyond, and with our reunions. It's like a family. You pick up where you left off. There's like no time has elapsed mm-hmm. In your conversations. And we're all getting older and grayer and fatter and slower and all that sort of stuff. But the friendship and the camaraderie and the bond is still there. And that's why I came out. I live on the west side of town. I came over today just to spray champagne on whoever gets to fly today and have a couple of meals with them and swap some stories and go from there.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate you sharing your experiences with us and to the listeners here. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the weekend. And I hope you guys have enjoyed listening to this episode of the podcast. So until next time, I'm Kevin Estello, Fieldcraft Survival. Thank you so much for listening. I'm here currently at Randolph Air Force Base in San Antonio, and I've had the distinct pleasure of meeting a number of prisoners of war from Vietnam, and this gentleman is no exception. Retired Colonel Bill Austin was an F-4 Phantom pilot. He was shot down on October 7th, 1967, and he was eventually repatriated on March 14th, 1973. He was the backseat pilot of an F-4 Phantom, and he spent a total of 5.5 years in captivity, which is pretty darn incredible. Prior to this podcast, I put out to Instagram and all social media, I said, if you want to ask a prisoner of war a question, what would you want to ask? And I printed out all those responses, and I've handed them over to Bill, and he's had a chance to take a look at them. Now, I've learned something as a podcaster over the years. Let your guests do the talking. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to stay out of this as much as I can. I might kind of steer Bill every once in a while, but with these guys, you know, they know how to answer questions, and their memory is impeccable. So I just want to sit back and listen as much as you do. So at this point, I'm just going to turn it over to retired Colonel Bill Austin. How are you, sir?
Hi. The question that is presented here is, did I have conversations with God? And if so, what did he say? Well, he didn't say anything. But let me relate my shoot down for just a moment here, and I think you'll understand where God entered in. We were hit, gradually losing hydraulics. We were descended down to about 10 or 12,000 feet, and we're about 60 miles south of Hanoi over a landmark we call Banana Valley. It was a banana-shaped lake with rice paddies all around. And as far as I know, we never dropped any bombs anywhere in close to that area. Punched out and was coming down over that in the rice paddies out there, but there were workers all out there in the field. So I pulled my chute down almost to 90 degrees and slipped the chute in and managed to get myself into the biggest tree in the area and bounced down off of limbs down through it. I had deployed my one-man life raft to cut down on my weight because with all my survival gear and everything, without the seat pack, I weighed 265 pounds. And that chute wasn't designed for that much weight. So I was coming down pretty fast. I went down through the tree and hit standing up on rock because I didn't know when the ground was coming. So I was just trying to make as small a target as I had, point my feet together and pointing them down through there. And miraculously, my parachute followed me right through without catching on a limb, and so did the life raft. At that point, now I'm standing on the ground. I took my helmet off and wrapped my parachute around it. And there was a tree over there that had blown over and left a hole in the ground, and it was full of black water. So I threw my helmet in there and the parachute wrapped around it, and it sunk. So it was an excellent place to get rid of the stuff I didn't want to carry. And I pulled my right life raft in and had my knife out and was going to stab my life raft to deflate it and put it in there. And about that time, about 50 yards away out there, I don't speak Vietnamese, but I knew dang well what was going on. So I thought about that for a few seconds and said, well, let's see. That big tree over there is at least 10 or 15 feet in diameter, maybe 20 feet in diameter that I came down. So that'd be a pretty good shield. And right just shortly behind it there, the way I wanted to go was a karst mountain and jungle. So I figured at 6'4" in athletic condition, that I could outrun any 5 foot Vietnamese. And so that was my plan, was to get the heck out of there. I before I did that, though, after they hollered at each other and everything, I pulled out my 38 and fired a tracer round out over the small brush where they were coming from the field out there, just to let them know that I was armed, because as I grew up, my dad ran a dairy farm and everything, and so I had experience, and I never saw my dad or me or anybody else carry a gun to the field, so I wasn't expecting them to be armed at that time. And I knew from coming down that the nearest village or hamlet or whatever you want to call it, there were three little encampments of about two or three buildings, all within about a half a mile. Each one of them about a half a mile away from where I was. So I figured if they had to run back to their house and get their gun, then I would be a long ways away by the time they got back. Just so happened that right after I fired, they returned fire. And oops, that's not working. So I tried to dive to get behind the tree. I was tackled, I thought. I didn't know what the work was going on, but I was thrown flat on the ground. I tried to crawl, and my right leg wouldn't move. My right foot wouldn't move. And turns out that in coming down into a standing landing on solid rock, that there was a crack in the rock. My boot lined up perfectly with the crack. You know, things just go sometimes bad. And the sole is like sticking an umbrella down in a hole. It rolled the sole, and the rubber sole, it went down in there. And it was only about 3 inches down in there, which didn't make me stand unusual. And I couldn't get it out. In fact, later on, after I finally got surrendered, the gooks had to cut down a small sapling, use it to pry my foot out, along with myself and two gooks pulling on my leg too. We finally got my foot out of that crack. So I was pinned down right on the spot. The gooks always say they capture you on the spot. They captured me on the spot. But let's go back. Now they're shooting at me. And I realized I can't crawl, I can't get away. So I said, okay, I guess this is it. I've got to surrender. I didn't plan to surrender. I had two full cases of ammunition in my survival, and I'm an excellent shot. So I had figured I would kill at least 100 gooks before I got out of there if I had to. But it wasn't much use where I was. But anyhow, I'm laying there I got up and put my hands up to surrender. The shooting intensified. Back down on the ground, tried once more to pull my foot, nothing happened. The shooting's following me down on the ground, but it's little bushes and all around me, and it's clipping off the bushes, and I can feel the bullets going by, but luckily none of them are hitting me. Got back up, hands up, then I realized I had my gun in my hand, so I threw it down, thinking they would see that and know that I'm surrendering. It didn't make any difference. So that time when I went down, I took a bullet in the left shin, right in the front of my left leg, and it sort of spun me around. My left leg flew up in the air as I went down, and I guess it caught the bullet. And at that point then, I decided that I had to have some help. So I turned to God and said, well, God, if this is it, let it happen. Let them hit me in the head and let it be over with, because I didn't want to be severely injured and have to be dragged 60 miles into Hanoi, you know, before I got any kind of medical attention, if I got any. So that was my prayer, and that's the end. My conscious brain shut off at that point. The next time my brain started acting again, I was standing up. In my life raft, there's a little thing called a sea anchor. It looks like a white parachute, nylon parachute, small. And as I came back to consciousness, I'm standing up now, and that as that comes in front of my face, my conscience starts working again, and I realize what's happening. Well, I think you know that I have a conversation with God, and I think he answered too. Next question. What was the first thing that I dreamed of eating when I got home? Steak. And that was a story in itself because, in all fairness, I guess the doctors really didn't know what kind of condition we were going to be in and everything and what our stomachs could stand and all. And I think the poor first guys that came home got a bunch of soup and stuff like that. And by the time I came out, third big group out, filet mignon. And we got to choose our steak. They had them laying out there raw, and we picked them up and told them how we wanted them cooked, and they cooked them and put them on your plate and et cetera, et cetera. So I got that steak. An interesting one there is in prison later on after 69, we started getting some packages from home. And one of the things that came in those packages was instant coffee. And you need boiling water to do that. But it just so happened that the Gooks normally boiled our water. And when we got it, even in the summertime, it was pretty hot when it came. So we could make coffee. And they also sent sugar and creamer, which I didn't use in my coffee at that time, but you got to do something with it. So I put sugar in there and I put cream in it and I drank my coffee and everything. So I'm sitting at the table there in at Clark, and I got a cup of coffee, and I put a spoonful of sugar in it and some cream there in it, put it to my lips, and it about made me sick. Oh, no way. I could not drink it. So I had to ask the young lady there if she would bring me another cup and get rid of this because I can't drink that. So I got that and got plain coffee and drank coffee, which I'd been drinking for years myself, just black coffee. And so that was an interesting thing there. But the food was outstanding. And, you know, got plenty of it. And the hospital there at Clark had been set up to receive us and everything. And of course, by the time I came out in three groups, the hallways all over the hospital were covered with posters made up by school children and everything. I mean, I spent probably that first night walking the halls, reading these posters and everything. And I'd like to say too, that the reception when I got off, I was in the third group. I got on the airplane and I was talking to the, flight nurse that was on there, and she said, you're not going to believe the reception you have at Clark. And I said, well, wait a minute now. We're the third group. I said, I understand the first group. Everybody's curious and all that, and they're out to do that. But by now, I doubt that we're going to get what you describe as the first two groups, but I was wrong. I think every American that was on the Philippine Islands was there to greet us, and I've never hugged so many people in my life. And it was a great reception. I did meet a family from, I'm from South Carolina. I met a family from Winnsboro, South Carolina, which some of my cousins, distant cousins, live there, and they knew of them. They had businesses there and everything. So it was a nice homecoming. I did that first night get to make a call to my wife, and let her know that I was above ground and doing okay. And I was in what you'd call pretty good shape, probably about 50 pounds less than what I weighed when I went over, but about 50 pounds heavier than the lightest I got there. that first winter there, this is leading into one of the other questions. The first winter there, I got some kind of green water, no flavoring or anything in it, but it was green and it was warm. And at the in the morning or 11 o'clock or so, I got it. Usually got a bowl of rice, and you could pour that green water over the rice, and it was warm. And okay, I love rice, so that worked out okay. But then in the evening, got that same green water, and you got a piece, a loaf of rancid, I mean really rancid, bread, much like the loaf you get at Subway and everything, about that size. But the inside was, shall we say, moist, very moist. And there was a lot of protein mixed in with it. Some people call those bugs, but they were protein. And so that sustained life, but I lost a lot of weight that first winter. And so much weight that my squadron mates who were shot down in August, I think it was 20th of August, they were in, after I moved into the zoo annex, I was able to get up on top of a wash basin they had out there and look across the fence and see one of the guys that I was shot down with. He didn't recognize me. I'd lost so much weight. Same way with one of the guys that was shot down there was in the building, in the room next door to me, with pretty thick wall between. We didn't have good calm there, but we made a hole in the fence outside in the brick wall that we could peephole, that we could watch through and see each other, and he couldn't believe that was me either. But anyhow, that sort of led into the question of what did I eat. It turned out that was water lily soup. They got the water lily out of the cesspool out there, boiled it, and that was the broth. I happened to be at the beginning. We were in the first room that got that, so they took the bowl with their thumb on the inside of the bowl and dipped it into the broth, and so all we got was broth. It was not until I moved into the room across the hallway there, or hallway in the outside fence there and everything. I moved over there, and I was at the end of the line. And so when we got water lily soup, I got water lily. And when we got potato soup, which we got a few times, I got plenty of potatoes because we were at the bottom of the bowl and we washed all the bowls for them and everything. So that put some weight back on me. I was able to gain some of my weight back. What does a good day as a POW look like? Well, interestingly enough, people talk about being in prison and everything, and they behind the bars and all, but a good day as a POW is stand behind the bars. As long as I was behind the bars, they didn't bother me, I didn't bother them. I didn't get interrogated or anything else. So really a good day is stand behind the bars all day. That sounds sort of unusual, but that really was my good day. And the thing I hated most was when I was in Heartbreak Hotel, my turnkey, which let's put it this way, I had inadvertently thrown him across the room into the corner. He hit about 4 feet up in the air when I was being interrogated in a big room. And I don't think he liked me. And I didn't like him either. He did the torture. And anyhow, when he would come in the front gate in the morning, he had a big ring of keys, and he would rattle those keys. And that was a sound that I hated, because when you heard the keys rattling, they're coming to get somebody to go to quiz. And it might be you, or it might be one of the other guys in the cells, you know. But quiz was not a good thing. Usually, you could end up in leg irons or some other kind of so to speak, uncomfortable positions. And so a good day is not being interrogated and not having your friends interrogated. It it improved as time went on. And when Ho Chi Minh passed away in, I think it was September 69 or something like that, then the Goots made an effort to improve our treatment. I'm now down to the question says, what were you given to eat? And I want to cover this again because I told you about the water lily soup. Well, I was one of the 208 that were moved up to the China border to be held as hostages, supposedly, but the October agreement that Dr. Kissinger initialed on and President Nixon looked at, the Vietnamese were going to hold 200 prisoners until the coalition and government was in place down south. All of the Americans were out of Vietnam, and the U.S. had either repaired or paid for all the damage that they had done in their bombing. Well, I would probably still be there today because I don't think they were going to do that. But anyhow, thank goodness President Nixon read that and said, nope, send the B-52s back again for the second round. And that brought us home. So my hat's off to those guys that risked their lives up there on a one-way trip. Initially, they thought that they were going to have a large percentage of the B-52s shot down that first night. Turned out they didn't have anywhere near what they thought, and things worked out a lot better. But I'm getting back now. I'm up here at Dog Patch was the name of our camp up on the China border. And we'd been there for a while. I don't remember how long, but it'd been a good little while. And there was a village down right below our camp, a little bit village there in the valley out there. There was not even a road to this village. The six by trucks that brought us in were in low gear, grinding along a path, just a path. And that was a very much a camouflaged unknown camp, so to speak. And anyhow, we were in there, and they killed a water buffalo. And they served the most beautiful piece of meat that I think I've ever seen from a hungry guy. I got a chunk of water buffalo that was 3 inches by 2 inches thick by about 4 inches. I mean, and it was as tender as could be. I mean, it was unbelievable. Well, I'm pretty sure that was a tenderloin off of that water buffalo. And I thought about it later because they killed another water buffalo a month or so later. And this time we got the knuckles and the bones and the cartilage. I mean, it was all rough. And I figured out what happened is when they cut the meat up, the water buffalo up, they put the tenderloin and all the good meat over into one basket, and they put all the scraps over into the other basket. Well, the cook messed up somewhere, and they gave us the good meat. That didn't happen again. We never got that good meat again, but I tell you, that was an outstanding piece of meat. And for a guy that grew up on red meat and rice and potatoes, that was a good day for a POW. That's about it. Going back to Hanoi, I went into the plantation, which was the old French consulate, and General Flynn was our SRO there, and we saw, they announced to us late January there that we were going home, had a formal announcement by the camp commander through an interpreter, and we did, General Flynn had said, we will show no emotion. So we had seen these, I'd say some of the lens on those television cameras were, or maybe they weren't television cameras, but cameras were at least a foot across up there on the second floor of the house. We'd seen them setting those up. So we didn't want to get any propaganda. So we all stood at attention while the camp commander he started reading what he was supposed to tell us through an interpreter. And then when we didn't react, he took over in English. He spoke some broken English and he tried to tell us again. And we still didn't react. And he said, go back to your room. So General Flynn dismissed us. And I might say that this is the first time that the Vietnamese recognized the our command structure and everything, General Flynn and other officers there, and allowed us to operate like we should have been operating all along. And, you know, the camp thing would probably run a lot better if they would had recognized the rank and structure that the U.S. had, but they did everything to discount that. And in fact, one of the rooms I lived in, they came in and designated a young lieutenant as the senior for a 40-something man room. And he did all the conversation, official conversation with the GOOP. And of course, all he did is come back, talk to the SRO and say, what do we want to do on this? And he'd go back and tell the guy. So, you know, it was different, but, I survived and actually came out in pretty good physical condition. Proud to say that I did not have a cavity in my mouth. The guy that cleaned my teeth said, your teeth are cleaner than most of the smokers that I clean teeth now. But I was surprised the Gooks gave me a toothbrush and some toothpaste made by the Hanoi Soap Works. And I finally swallowed my last bite of meat, and as quick as I did, I started brushing my teeth. So, or when I got meat or whatever I was eating. And so that toothbrush was well appreciated and certainly contributed to that. Physically, I was in, my wife said that I was in too good a shape. I about wore her out traveling around and trying to keep up with me. I weighed 172 pounds and I'm normally about 220. And, the crazy thing was they held me at a hospital at Maxwell. Everybody else went on and I'm still there. And I said, why am I been able to go? And they said, well, the doctors are holding you. And so I went to the doctor and said, why am I being held? And he said, we don't understand. Your blood is saturated with protein. My wife says, all you have to do is watch what he eats and how much he eats, and you know why it's saturated with protein. So I went home that next day. That's all I have to say. It was a experience that you wouldn't want to wish on anybody, but it was also a learning experience. And I was fortunate enough. I had nearly 200 different roommates over the period of 5.5 years. I moved around from camp to camp, and I learned a lot about people, and that helped me in my command. The last command I had, with the people I chose, 4 best in the Air Force, divisions and squadrons. So again, the people that I was able to figure out, these guys can do it. And the young captain, one of the captains that won best in the Air Force, I think he took home, he and his GS-13, female assistant, they got awarded, $16,000 for their idea that saved the Air Force some $16 million.
Wow. So, I mean, I've just been sitting back here listening and just in shock, right, of everything that you've gone through. And you just said something that I think we can end with. And you said you learned a lot about people. What do you think is the overarching or the universal characteristic or attribute of a person who's able to survive what you survived? What do you think is the common thread?
Tenacity.
So what do you think is the common thread of all the prisoners of war who made it out, who were able to fight and who were able to survive?
Well, of the 200 I lived with over the years, there were many, many different personalities, many, many different ways of coping with stress, from guys walking around after something that we didn't like happened and everything, and their teeth are clenched, their muscles in their face are they're killing themselves more or less with the stress, and that was one thing that I had to face. I was a vegetable when I came out of interrogation. I couldn't walk or stand or anything. My hands were drawn back. My arms were numb from the elbows down. My legs were numb from knees down. My foot had what's called foot droop. And it just hung like a piece of meat down there. And so I didn't think I would survive. I had no idea that I would survive. I hated these people. I already had it in my mind. Well, I didn't have any feeling. I couldn't use my hand. I still had an elbow. And my plan was to kill that guy. The turnkey that had tortured me, I was going to kill him. He knew that because he never came in my room. He would never come in. He would slide to open the door and slide the bowl of soup or water, whatever you want to call it. He'd slide it in with his foot. And same thing with a bowl of rice, and he'd throw the bread on the bed in, but he would never come inside the door. Because, like I say, I'd already thrown him across the room, and he knew that I could kill him in an instant if I ever got my hands on him. And so I realized all of a sudden that my insides were being eaten up, and I had. And growing up and everything, I remember a sermon by a preacher in my church, and the sermon was on love and hate, and he drew a circle. And no matter where it's love or hate, either one of them, with a lot of intensity, takes the same out of your body. You love, you freely give of yourself. Hate, you involuntarily give of yourself, but both of them come together and give out. Basically, they take of your body. And at that point, then I said, I got to do something. You know, I got to do something different. So I more or less treated the goops in with indifference. And the hate was gone. I got rid of that, tried to understand a little bit where they were coming from and everything. And not that I liked them or approved of what they were doing or anything, but I understood a little bit where they were coming from and what they were thinking, and just try to stay ahead of them. Wow.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. I appreciate everything you've done for this country, and I wish you all the best in life. I mean, what an incredible story.
Thank you, Kevin.
Guys, another one, absolutely amazing. I'm lost for words. This has been the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. Until next time.